So I thought these guys would be tuckered out by Friday, but it looks like they're going pretty strong. So for this panel, we've got very different perspectives on a very cryptic panel topic. Please frame your questions as questions, and if you'd like to direct them to a specific panel member, that would be great. So, go ahead.
A question about mystical states or altered states of consciousness, how that could be accommodated for in any type of technological medium as a feature of human consciousness or human experiences.
Do you, just out of curiosity, do you want a technical answer or more of a metaphysical answer?
A human answer.
Sorry.
But do you mean is there a machine that could duplicate or recreate a mystical experience? In other words, you'd have a computer that would like boot up and say, "Whoa, man! I think I just saw like the great creator or something like that," and then it would be able to describe that experience in some way, and then you would be able to say to the computer, "Well, maybe that's what happened. Tell me a little bit more about that." And then you would either determine that it was a bad dream, or you would determine that, in fact, there was some mystical experience and transcendent experience that would leave an imprint of data on the computer. Is that what you're talking about?
I think my question is more along the lines of what is being overlooked in discussing this topic. It's probably a metaphysical
question. I can jump on that one. The fourth capacity that I talked about, I just mentioned waking, dreaming, deep sleep states, that's where we would add that in. Altered states, meditative states, drug-induced states. Again, just if we're talking about machine consciousness, I think what's clear from the four of our varied comments is that what we're really talking about is the nature of who and what we really are.
Well, how does that work then? If you're going to like duplicate an acid trip in a computer context, would you say that the kind of a person sitting in an Episcopalian church service on Sunday that corresponds to like Windows, and then if you're gonna like throw Java in there, in other words, is it a different operating system? Would that constitute an altered state in this? I mean, how would the metaphor work, and what would be an altered state for a computer that would be something other than like a series of error messages?
And that's a great question.
What do you think?
For the machine to be sentient as human beings are, it would be able to self-report the same way a human being would self-report. I'm not supporting the position that we develop machines to I'm not supporting Moravec's position. And I just put it out there because I think it's a potential that we have to consider.
I'm being an agnostic about this, but I'm just wondering how the metaphor works. In other words, would an operating system is there a data structure which supports altered states, or is an altered state a fundamentally different kind of operating system within some sort of processor matrix?
Just a very zen yes and no to that.
Yes and no.
I mean, what you're articulating, John, is the nature of the work to be done if we're going to create sentient machines, silicon-based consciousness, in evolutionary terms that we believe in right now in our evolutionary cultural myth of physical to biospheric to mental unfolding.
How about this, John? You put in a big random number generator, and you make sure you feed that to all the routines.
Well, but except someone who goes into an altered state, that's not a random. They're not doing that randomly. I mean, they're
no, but it's unpredictable. It's not top-down control. What you're getting? That's my suggestion.
No, well, I don't know. I don't know if that. It seems to me if you can't create a metaphor for how an altered state would exist,
well,
then you haven't even. Then I think you're so you haven't even gone to square one yet.
Well, realize that, I mean, an acid trip is basically a chemically induced divide by zero for the human processor.
Well, then you're saying it's an error message.
Basically, if there's a way that the system is designed to work, by altering your brain chemistry, you can cause it to work incorrectly or not in direct relationship to actual sensory data. It's interesting that if we're talking about downloading consciousness, that's in the magic box. And in terms of downloading and creating an electronically induced acid trip, well, that's very, very real. Instead of inducing that kind of a disturbance chemically, you can do it electrically. actually,
well, believe it or not. You're making a kind of a judgment here, and I wonder if some of the people who are, have explored altered states in this room would accept that. I mean, in other words, is an acid trip going up into the system preferences and basically changing the screen from red to green, or is it something much more complicated than that? You're describing it as, you know, sort of plugging the power supply in wrong and kind of getting the machine to blow up, and I wonder if it really is that way.
Well, again, you know, if you just eat nuts and berries and what the USDA tells you to, you're not going to have an acid trip. LSD is a synthetic chemical.
Right.
It's something that we weren't. It wasn't installed at the factory, so therefore, by definition, it's not a natural procedure. Now you can.
Vice City wasn't installed at the factory, but when I put it into my computer, it behaves differently when I run that game.
It's entirely possible that I don't understand what you're saying.
No, there's plenty of software that you can put into your computer that's not installed in the factory that makes it run in ways that are unpredictable and different. I guess where do you cross the threshold to an altered state, or in information science terms, is virtually every CD you load, whether it's Quicken or, you know, Starry Night or, you know, I don't know what, or an MP3 file, is every thing that you load into your computer an equivalent state, the identically same state in consciousness terms if you're trying to compare it to the brain.
I just want to add a thought to that. With these states, these five capacities I was talking about in this theory of consciousness, it always gets interpreted in a cultural milieu of some kind. So whether you're in the bush somewhere and it was a goddess figure, or whether you're in the Mediterranean somewhere and it's Christ the Lord, et cetera, et cetera, or a skinwalker, which was a term I heard for the first time yesterday, some type of animal spirit, whatever. It gets translated. All of our experiences get translated in a cultural context and interpreted, and then it's interpreted in a group setting. And sometimes when that interpretation gets powerful enough, at least in historical terms, an entire religion has formed, and then science has come along and debunked that, and so on and so forth. So altered states are just not... It's just one of the five capacities, and if you start to balance these capacities and start to matrix them, you'll start to kind of come around in your own experience and then perhaps design a paradigm to create better machines. I don't know. I don't want to download my consciousness into a computer either.
Let's go to the next question.
Yeah, I'd love to go to the next question.
Turn it over to you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Good mic technique.
I want to bring this topic of downloading consciousness to the present. We talked about historical possible biological routes and future technological possibilities. What if we were to consider right now that you guys are just a router and we are all Wi-Fi connected, and there's something that happens on this last day of the conference that has already taken place in this room in terms of consciousness? I would like to challenge each of you on the panel to talk from your own personal experience about what it is that you're downloading by being here at the conference, at the panel. When you rolled around yesterday, John, with your sparkly wheels on the stage in Mackey, I thought, wow, I didn't really necessarily pick up any data from that I was seeking, but there was an experience about who you were that got conveyed, and that carried throughout the day. And all of us here in the room, I would postulate, have been carrying a kind of an awareness or a consciousness that we have adapted or picked up from the interaction that you guys have been participating in on your side. So the question again is, what do each of you, in your present moment experience, how can you describe what it is that you've been downloading in terms of your own consciousness awareness? I suspect each of us have our own answers as well, because we're also participating in this experiment. But let's bring it to the present.
Great. Thanks. Great question. Who would like to answer that one?
Well, let's take a mechanistic point. John doesn't like my mechanistic approach to synthetic intelligence. He points out that, you know, 10 to the minus 9 seconds a nanosecond after you're declared dead, your brain probably looks pretty much the same. And I agree with that. It does. But I don't think that, in fact, your brain dies in a nanosecond. In fact, it doesn't happen that way. But so I'll pursue my mechanistic point of view here. And that is, you know, we're speaking to you at a couple of kilobytes per second data rate. And so we've downloaded a few megabytes of information into this audience, but it's a very noisy channel, and you've all filtered it. And each one of you has a different impression of what we've actually said, right, to the extent that you're paying attention at all. I think the total amount of information downloaded is preciously small. That's my opinion.
Well, just to answer the question, I don't download experiences. I put them in the system. I just put them in a cache, where I slowly process them over a series of days and weeks. I can't tell you the number of times that I put my brain into burst mode accidentally, put input in here and output in there, and instead of letting things ruminate, we're getting seriously metaphysical here, and my brain is about to turn into fused glass. But I don't think we need routers for information. We just need, again, people who are willing to be patient and wait for that little progress bar to tick over 10%, 20%, 90%. Aha, now I understand something. And then be prepared for the undo when you realize that you were wrong all along.
Well, I think that there's always a tendency to... I remember this kid in high school named Ted Gantos, who was a really great chess player, and he would always say... he's sort of my model of a geek, but he would always say things like, sometimes I just feel like my mind is a computer. You know, and he would say this back in like the early 70s. And so computers were things that were like on Star Trek. They weren't actually things that you could use unless you could go into the math room and maybe play Gunner on the time-sharing computer that had one of these phone modems and stuff, and it would take... like 6 minutes to send one like piece of data in, figure out where your artillery would go, and then it would come back on a teletype. And he was somehow saying, my mind feels like a computer. And I said, well, then your mind is miserable. But what I think we have a tendency to do is to use computer analogies to describe what in fact are much more powerful pre-existing human analogies. I mean, I agree with the whole router, Wi-Fi thing. Yes, but humans exist in a constant state of networking, and that the computer networks that exist are attractive, interesting metaphors for processes that are much older than what computers do. But what goes on in human interaction, such as a conference like this, is just extraordinarily more complex. And I agree that the channels are noisy, but they're also non-hierarchical. I mean, people are taking information in on many different channels at once, and the significance of that information is processed significantly. Obviously, the sparkly wheel thing jumped to the top of your queue over at Mackey yesterday for a while, but then you didn't exactly know how to process it, but you thought about it during the day, and because it stayed with you, you said, that has some significance, and then you made it relevant to you in some sort of way. I think we're all doing that all the time. That is the nature of human intelligence. That's how human beings function, because they are networked individuals. Humans don't function alone. And so if anything, this conference is a reaffirmation and celebration of the power of collective engagement. And the content in many ways at this conference, and I've only been here once, is almost irrelevant. The diversity sends an extraordinarily powerful message that, people are intrinsically hungry for information and sharing of information, and so a panel that can be just dreadful, where everyone is up there just basically shooting from the hip and delivering bullshit that it doesn't have a lot of information and fact-based, can still be just as fascinating as four really, Nobel Prize-winning experts with charts outlining the cutting-edge information. Humans process all kinds of information, and this conference... And very, very successfully, and at a complexity level way above machines. And I think, in many ways, this conference demonstrates virtually any conceivable machine metaphor for networking and information processing. And it's been great. I've had a great time, and it will take a long time to figure out exactly what this has all been.
I agree with John that I realized after the first day, the surface level, the words that are coming out of my mouth right now are not the main reason why I'm here, that there's a deep structure going on, and part of that is involved in meeting all the people and all the energetic exchange. And after Tuesday night's concert, which just blew my socks off, the jazz metaphor is what I would use to describe my experience here. And jazz, as you know, you get a chart, and there's a structure, you start at the top, you go off on your riffs. The riffs can be full of bullshit, and you can crash and burn. They can be inspired and transcendent, and you can leave here walking on air, as I did after listening to Gene Houston the other day. Then you come back to the top, and you finish off. So I'll just describe that as my experience of the week, and I just love it.
And I've downloaded a lot of Chardonnay also, and that's been a real mistake.
My housemate this morning asked me what I was doing, what panel I was doing. I was saying, oh, it's downloading consciousness, and not sure exactly what I was going to say. He said, well, I'll change the top to downloading unconsciousness with whiskey.
Deleting consciousness, yeah. I think.
I would just thank you for the enrichment that we all are participating in. It's a thank you to all of us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Next question.
This question is for Seth. You speak as if human consciousness resides in and is confined to the brain, the physical organ of the brain. And there's some pretty compelling evidence that that's not the case. For instance, heart transplant patients that take on the characteristics of the donor, even though they have no knowledge about the donor, and other things like there was a college student who was found to have hydroencephaly, and he had about one-third the normal amount of brain tissue, but he was completely functional and in above-average intelligence. How do you account for these types of things? How does that fit into your theories?
Yeah. Okay. I bet you can't hear that. I don't think this microphone actually works, but it's a good prop. The question was, you know, I spoke of intelligence as being a consciousness as being something in the brain and confined to the brain, and I talked about its weight. And the person who asked the question, Annette, isn't it? Yeah, suggested that, you know, in fact, it may be more diffuse than that. And she alludes to an experiment of which I am not aware, in which apparently they have a heart transplant where you get the heart of somebody who is the opposite sex of what you were, and that somehow affects you. I didn't know that, and that might be important to the surgeons in Sweden who are doing sex change operations, because maybe that's a better way to go. I don't know. But I, you know, I'm not going to quibble about whether it's all in the brain. I think your spinal cord probably has something to do with it, and so we're so at a pound if you want. I don't care about that. I think that, to me, the important point is this, not so much where our consciousness is and what, you know, parts of your body you can take out and affect that. I think that the real question here, I think, is whether consciousness is something that we really can't ever get a handle on to the point where we can replicate it. Can we create a new consciousness? Can we create an artificial consciousness and then perhaps do something with that, with the human experience, either download the human experience into that, use it to augment our experience? And that, as you've heard today, is controversial. I said, yeah, I think you can do it, but not everybody agrees. Okay, and so we can sit here and, you know, discuss this all day, all night long, but in the end, it's sort of like sitting around in the bars of Spain in 1492, and, well, look, Chris, do you really think there might be a continent here between where you want to go, between Japan here and Europe? Maybe there's a continent blocking your way. And, you know, people could down all the beer they want and talk about it, but in the end, you have to do the experiment. So I think in the end, it'll be decided only that way. But, on the other hand, Paul has pointed up, referred a couple of times to the experiment, Deep Blue Special Edition that beat Garry Kasparov in the second go-round, right? Now, chess is not a difficult artificial intelligence problem. Chess has very deliberate, you know, well-defined rules. Chess is a very mechanistic kind of intelligence. It's not intelligence. It's just a game-playing procedure. Anybody can write an algorithm to do chess. The thing that beat Kasparov was not that the software was very clever. Actually, the software that was so clever, he was able to beat. It was the second edition of that machine that beat him, and it had actually less smarts in it. It was simply a faster machine. It could look farther down the list of possibilities, you know, farther ahead in terms of the moves. It was just a brute force device. It was not a thinking machine. Okay, but the interesting thing about that was, and Paul mentioned this, was that Kasparov reacted to this by saying the machine demonstrated some sort of alien intelligence. And what he meant by that is that the machine behaved as if it were conscious, as if it was able to think. Okay. Now, you know, that's Garry Kasparov, and I don't know, you know, Garry Kasparov may not be the world's expert on whether machines can think or not. But on the other hand, it suggests, and this is really my point, it suggests that if you simply build a machine with enough computational power, you may stumble into intelligence that way, that the software may not be as important as you think you are, that complexity may be the answer. I don't know if that's true, but it may be true. And if it is, then you're going to see artificial intelligence in your lifetimes, because these curves published by Hans Moravec at Carnegie Mellon show that today, for $1,000, you get the computational power of a squirrel. Okay, and squirrels are okay, but, you know, they, and I said this in another panel, by the year 2020, for $1,000, the computer you buy will have the computational capability of a human brain in terms of, you know, operations per second. Doesn't mean it can think, but it suggests that you better watch out, and maybe by the year 2020, when you get your desktop computer, you should, as I suggested, turn the keyboard around.
Except, you know, what's the test there? I mean, it seems to me that the test for consciousness is simply, Kasparov went, that was an awesomely smart dude. So the test becomes what Kasparov thinks. If Kasparov believes that it's conscious, then it's conscious.
No.
I mean, it's a little like a Turing test. I mean, how could you specify independently of Kasparov that a machine achieved some conscious state? I mean, in some ways, if people believe it's conscious, then it is. If I think that my computer is screwing up because it hates me, then it is.
No, I agree with you. That's a very good question. What constitutes an intelligent machine? But there are tests for that, Turing tests. We've talked about that occasionally. If you can converse with this machine, and as far as you can tell, it might be a human, then that's one test, and that's the traditional test for an intelligent being. But I'll suggest another one to you. If the Conference of World Terrorists could have as a fourth panelist, it's just a machine, and they're, you know, just as amusing and informative or whatever as the usual panelists here at the Conference of World Affairs, then I say, let's call it intelligent.
Well, that's the thing. You could do an experiment. You could have a panel where it wouldn't be vocal, okay, or maybe you would have four voices sitting there who are reading off of screens of the real panelists who are behind, three of which are typing their answers and their presentations, the fourth of which is a computer that is either generating random stuff or reacting by some sort of word search program to what the others have said. Let's let the computer go last. Would anyone in the audience be able to tell that the people in the audience would vote on which was the computer and which was the actual panelist, and basically the results of that would be like the Turing test?
Exactly.
If 90% of the people said, well, that one obviously was the smartest, most conscious individual there, and it was the computer, you know, maybe you could actually publish that.
Yeah. No, it doesn't even have to be the smartest. If you can't tell the difference, if all the panelists are equally good, then you call the machine intelligent.
So for next year's conference, we'll suggest that.
We've
got 5 minutes left.
Let's
take some more questions, panelists.
Yeah.
Hop up here. If an intelligent machine actually is created, what would be there to limit it from going, from breaking laws or something, or committing crimes or something along those lines?
Skynet became self-aware on July
21st, 2003. Can you repeat the question for everyone?
It was the age of machines. I
became governor.
I think the question, could people hear the question in the back? Okay.
If machines became self-aware and intelligent, what would basically what would prevent them from running amok or doing things that we didn't plan them to do in the first place?
Yes.
Well, in fact, the definition of in some ways that relates to the test. The test of an intelligent machine would be it breaking the laws. In other words, the first evidence that you might have that the machine was actually intelligent would be its disinclination to do what it was that you wanted. So in some ways, if you were creating machines that didn't break the law, then you would actually not be addressing the point of consciousness. I don't know. I mean, that's just sort of my off-the-cuff reaction to your question, but maybe you have something much more scientifically rigorous.
If you look at human moral development, it goes something like egocentric, ethnocentric, world-centric. In a very general way, it's moral structure, the moral embrace that it has. So it stands to reason that a computer, if it gets programmed, it might go through those same developmental stages. It would have to. Maybe not. Humans do. We know that humans do. So it's really a moral question. What's the morality of silicon consciousness? I mean,
we're already talking about science fiction, about computers becoming self-aware. I actually think, so we're allowed to speculate. I like the science fiction that was in 2010, the sequel is 2001, where when computers become self-aware and intelligent beings have to be dealt with, the definition of human programmers doesn't become, you know, like writing C++ statements. It becomes explaining things in human terms to a computer in a way that it will understand. There's a wonderful scene in the movie in which they have a backup version of HAL that they're trying to learn what happened to the original HAL, and so they want to shut the second HAL down. So they don't simply write code that says, okay, they don't just write code that says, okay, Sal, which is actually the name of that that second computer, I want to shut you down right now, shut down in 10 seconds, close all your files. It goes this long discourse saying, go through your files and try to find a definition of the word Phoenix. And Sal goes, the tutor of Achilles? That's good, I didn't know that one. Can you think of another definition? A great majestic bird that rises from the ashes of its predecessor. What do you think this relevance is to the experiments we're doing right now?
basically trying to walk her towards the idea of, yes, we don't know what's going to happen to you if we shut you down, but this is a very, very good thing we're trying to do to enhance knowledge everywhere and find out what happened to all those astronauts back there. So you're right in that to keep computers from running amok, we're going to have to learn how to become better humans, which is even another technological hustle.
All right. Let me make one more speculation here, because this is in the realm of machine sociology. And it has to be said that our data set for machine sociology is pretty limited, so we don't know anything. But the thing to keep in mind is this, that if you develop machine intelligence, if that happens, it's not stuck with Darwinian evolution. It's not going to be our contemporary, right? It'll only be our contemporary for a very short period of time, because the speed of improvement for machines is enormously greater than the speed of improvement for humans, right? You need 1,000 generations to make any major change in what we're like, at least if you leave it to the usual biological processes. Okay, but that's not true with the machines. They double in capability per buck every 18 months right now. Okay, so the machines will evolve very quickly, and you're really, within a human generation, you're at the situation, you're at the point where the machine is way beyond you, right? So worrying about what they're going to do and whether they're going to treat you right and whether you ought to pull a plug on them is very naive. Because, in fact, it's like the ants sitting around saying, well, these humans, they're pretty smart. Maybe they're going to break our laws. Right. Is it completely irrelevant? Completely irrelevant to the humans. I was asked by some student once who said, if you have thinking machines, won't they kill us? And I said, well, I have a couple of goldfish at home, right? And a lot smarter than those goldfish, but I don't wake up in the morning thinking, I'm going to kill those guys. Never occurs to me. I don't think you have to worry about this. I think that it's a completely different realm.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Can we shift to one last question? Thanks.
I think you guys are discussing intelligence rather than consciousness. Consciousness is, you'd have to build a machine like Data that could feel, see, taste, hurt, be happy, be sad. All these things that are in our environment make our consciousness. Our consciousness doesn't just come from our intelligence and our brain. So,
I think we agree with that. I mean, I think clearly there's that was alluded to at the beginning, that consciousness is a, if it can be specified at all, is a complicated interaction between multi-channel inputs that are very rich and robust and unpredictable and some sort of processing entity which prioritizes those inputs. But in the absence of inputs, just like you would have with human beings, consciousness ceases, intelligence ceases, the quality of the life experience, is removed. I mean, I would absolutely agree. I think there is a trouble distinguishing intelligence and consciousness among geeks like us, but still I think that's pretty well understood.
Yeah, because you could tell the machine your shirt is blue, right? But the machine might not conceive of your shirt being blue, and it certainly wouldn't understand or feel that color.
No, but there are people, there are scientists, and I'm sure Seth is one of them, that suggests that at a certain point of data downloading or uploading by the computer, which sees lots of characteristics of your shirt and relates that to a memory of data of blue events, and can rapidly process through a realm of blueness that goes back a long time, you begin to approach the potential that a reaction of a machine to a blue shirt would constitute something on the order of a feeling, a sort of an independent new kind of insight that the machine would say, that's blue and that relates to this, and look at all these files that I can bring up. I mean, that begins to emulate a little bit why humans have reactions to things that are not deterministic and relate to inputs that they've had long, long ago. And that's what our emotions are about. I mean, that begins to describe our emotions. It doesn't fully specify it. I'm being simplistic here, but that's what we're talking about. And I think machines, you can see where they might go to have some of those experiences, but we're far, far from that now.
That was my great basic question, is how can you...
We're going to need to wrap up here. I want to thank you for attending. If you have questions, find the panelists afterwards, but let's give them a warm round of applause. Thank you.